Hi, I'm Zara. I'm an addict. I'm not sure if I really need this. Can you hear me at the back? Fantastic. I'm going to move it back a little bit. I don't like them. As I said, I'm Zara. I'm an addict. And really quite nervous. I'd much rather be doing the 15-minute one. My sponsor's done quite a few here, and all she said was breathe and be authentic. And authentic I can be, because my memory's shot to shit, so I can't lie. So whether you identify or not here today, I'm not special. I like to think I'm a bit different, but I'm not really. I'm a bog-standard addict. And on the other hand, I call my mum up and said, I'm doing this big show, I've got to speak for 40 minutes. And she, the first thing she said was, I think you should tell her what's been going on with me. And I was like, usually I go, oh, Mum, stop telling me what to say, because, you know, she is an addict. She also has bipolar. She's dual diagnosis and a whole host of other things, and has tried to control me and everyone in her vicinity all her life. And rather than start put up a fight, which is my normal behaviour, I said, thank you, Mum. I'll do that. And then she carried on, and I said, on that note, I really have to go now. I suppose the best thing is to start at the beginning. Only child. I hadn't met another only child till I came into recovery. There's a few of us, which is quite nice to hear. At age 3, my mum took me to see a psychiatrist because I was displaying behavioural things, and he said I was self-willed, stubborn, and self-obsessed, and not a lot's changed in all those years. I'm not going to say quite how many, because I'm never quite sure how old I am. It all usually depends on who I'm talking to. I know the year I was born, and that's okay, and I can sit quite comfortably in that. Only child, Irish Protestant Catholic mother, Russian Manc Jewish father. So when I first saw the word gods in going through the steps for the first time in 1997, I was like, oh God, here we go. But I have my own God today, and I choose to call it God. I don't know if it's a him or her, it depends on what kind of mood I am. A lot of the time, and for many years, it's you lot and my sponsor and my friends, but that was a long time to find. From the age get-go, never really liked reality. I think my first memory was one of my first birthdays, and there was a party at our place just before my mum burnt it down, accidentally at that time. The mini wasn't an accident, but that's okay. And there was a rabbit hutch, and I remember looking at all these kids thinking, I want to be in that hutch with that rabbit, because that felt safe, and they didn't. And I've always felt I have felt different from other people. I didn't find it easy to socialise with other children, yet when I'm comfortable with people, as those who know me, I don't shut up. Yet as a child, I've spent many, many times sitting at the table with my mother saying, say something. And the more someone stage whispers that at you, the less likely I am to say anything. But I could read and read and read and read and read, you know, a book, two books a day, no problem. That was probably my first obsessive, addictive, getting away from reality and ending up in another reality, which is what a lot of my using was about. I had my first drink aged about 11 and a half. I'd gone out with the big boys, and my girlfriend, who was the younger sister of one of them, said, for God's sake, have a drink, because if you do, you know, you'll be a bit more lively. And I had 5, and I was, and then I threw up. And then she put me in a cab, and I lied to my mum the next day. Well, I lied to my mum saying that she'd thrown up on me. She then called up because she was a bit worried that I might have choked in the night of my own puke. And I learned then I had to lie better. I've never had a very good memory even then, but I knew that if I was going to carry on in life doing things that went against the grain, I'd have to learn to lie, to the point where it became compulsive. I also learned that I wasn't actually that keen on alcohol. It was never my drug of choice, but it changed the way I felt, and that was the thing. Whatever type of drug it was, it would alter the way I felt. It would allow me also to become someone I thought you wanted to be. Not that I ever asked anyone what you wanted me to be, it was just my take on it. And the various Zaras created over the years were not great. They were annoying. They were sad. They were funny occasionally, but they weren't me. They had a little tiny essence of me, usually a bit of a madam, and that really hasn't changed. But it took a long time in recovery to get back to me, to discover who I really was. My whole drugalogue was pretty much bog standard. I went up to school, I was sent to school in Scotland at 13 because I was drinking too much and staying out late in London. And the first person I met was on mushrooms. And he's now dead. He died when I was 17, driving under the influence of various drugs away from a rave, crashed, had a heart attack. And that was the first person I met that was on drugs, and it was the first person I met that had died as a result. There's been a lot of death in my recovery story, and I won't apologise now, but it's not been great. And where I was at school, drugs just grew there. We had mushrooms used to grow on the rugby field. I used to do community service once a week, and other people joined, like, the fire service, the special life service, the special boat rescue, the air training corps. And no, I went off in a minivan with a load of older boys each week, and rather than go to visit the old people or the nursery school, we used to go round to this little village called Nairn, which turned out to be pretty much one of the drugs capitals of Scotland, because that was where all the drugs would come in. And I learnt what a nine bar was, and I learnt how to hot knife, and then I learnt what MDMA was, and and it was that whole thing. By 85, it was like the summer of love, and, you know, ecstasy was out, and it all seemed like fun. And I'd gone from not smoking to not puffing to not doing Class A's to not doing coke. And the day I left school was the day that I first did coke, and then I freebase. And very, very quickly, by the way, I'd never moved back home again. I made sure I moved out, moved in with my friend. And it was great because there was no adults there. There was no restriction that I had when I was at school. I'd see my parents once a week. I'd ask if I could borrow the silver carriage clock because we didn't have a clock. My mum would give me a bit of food. I would say, we've got no photos up. Could I have really nice silver frames, that look really lovely. And what I do is I then go round to the pawnbrokers in Victoria, Sutton's. I knew about Sutton's because my mum had taken me there a lot as a little girl. My father had gone to work abroad. They're still married, don't know how. And she had no money, so I was kind of used to the bailiffs and stuff like that, knocking on the door. I was used to, our family, it was feast or famine. There wasn't kind of anything in between. And that goes the way through, at least on my father's side of the history, it was all or nothing. And from the age of about 18, when I left school, I went to university, dealt with university, it's the only time I went in. Don't know how I actually managed to pass. My college tutor wasn't quite sure how I'd managed to pass as well. I actually got quite a good degree. My father wasn't sure how I'd managed to pass. But I manage. I always manage. And it was then get a job. And I got the job. And I had this wonderful habit of each job I started, I'd do nothing but puff in the week. Nothing till Friday. And then it'd be Saturday, Sunday. Then it would be, after a week, it'd be, a little bit on Thursday, because Thursday's Friday. and then it'd be Wednesday, Thursday, Friday. And then Tuesday. Wow, Tuesday was like the new, that was a good time to go out. And then eventually it'd just be Monday night was the night where I wouldn't do any Class A's. And then it was every night. And from that must have been about 1990 to 97, I remember looking back and there honestly wasn't a day when there wasn't some kind of drug in my system, the minimum being one. I remember for about 4 days I only had alcohol. And as I said, I'm not much of a drinker, and most of my, I'd rather forget my shameful moments would happen when I couldn't get any gear. And it was just the alcohol. And I'm much happier using because I'm not touching anyone, I'm not going near you, and quite frankly, no one's going near me. My using, though, all jokes apart, put me in positions that I wouldn't wish on my worst enemy. Stuff that makes me feel sick to the stomach and grateful that I'm still alive. I have learned over the years to take responsibility for all of that. You know, the positions I put myself in that no woman, or actually no man, should have to be. I'm alive, I'm intact. When I was about 20, my uncle, he's been in the fellowship for coming up to 30 years this year, had been telling my parents I had a problem with coke. And, you know, I copped to that. So that was it, wasn't doing anything else, it was just a thing. And I remember doing freebase. They brought me home for about a week and a half, and I remember freebasing above, because crack wasn't around at that time, well, it hadn't hit England. And no guilt, no shame, it was just an impediment and getting in my way of my using. And I moved out again and carried on getting the jobs. I went to two meetings, and they were talking about injecting. And I hadn't injected, I still haven't injected. And they were talking about crack, and I hadn't done crack at that point. And I was a lot younger. There weren't that many young people. And I was much more interested in this bloke, who I thought was Wolfie from Citizen Kane, than anything else. And the fact, the shame that I didn't have any money when they were handing around a saucer at the end. And I think, oh, my God, they think I spent it all on drugs. Well, of course I bloody had. And I went out. Oh, yeah, my godmother died that night. And my mum said, you don't have to go back to these meetings. She goes, I wouldn't hang my dirty linen out in front of strangers. And I thought, great. And actually, you're not strangers. And I carried on getting the jobs. I'd usually quit before they fired me because my using would get that bad. Petty cash would go missing. I have every illness and ailment under the sun. And, you know, relatives dying, lady bits being removed if it was a male boss. I mean, it's just... And I'm quite superstitious. I'm thinking about what you were saying. I'll be like, oh, my God, someone's going to die. And bizarrely enough, a couple of the funerals, you know, I had my grandfather die twice. And actually, in my fourth week in recovery, he died for real. So, you know, talk about be careful what you say. I don't really believe in be careful what you wish for, because I've wished for many things in recovery and I haven't really got them. When I have, it's a bit late and I don't really want them anymore. But by 97, my friends said don't tell the story, but I never really listened to what people say until I realised why it was a good idea and why it was a suggestion. But 2 o'clock in the morning, I'm on my hands and knees, crawling on the floor. I used to grow these two fingernails long so that I could scoop up any rocks I could find. And I'm down there. And for the first 4 years in my first recovery, it was like, you know, had, you know, the really expensive La Perla underwear, and it was all red. Actually, it was grey and it was dirty and it was turned inside out. And, you know, it was funny, but it wasn't, because I remember literally on my hands and knees praying. For the first time that I could recollect praying to a God to help me. And I still had Yellow Pages in those days. And I remember looking up, it was a more special and different fellowship. And although I went there the next day, I agreed with their, I got a lot of identification with their readings. Someone there said I'd have to give up everything. And I thought, oh, God. And so I detoxed myself over the next week, went to my doctor's, said I was fine, told my mother that I wasn't well. She slapped me in the face and said, yeah, go to your doctor's. And for me, for my first time, this is just my story, I was fortunate enough to go into treatment. I thought it was going to be 4 to 6 weeks. It turned out to be 1 week short of 6 months. And there I was introduced to me. And I was introduced to the 12-step program that is Narcotics Anonymous. And then I was reintroduced to me, and it was great for a week, and then it hurt like hell. It was really, really painful, especially having your peers just show you, tell you what your bad points were and your less finer points. And you know, I thank them now, and actually quite a few of them, which is rare, are still clean today. I can't see any in the room. But, you know, that was 97. That was over, you know, 16 years ago. And I went to halfway. That took a little bit longer because apparently I couldn't get step three. And I still battle with step three. I am full of self-will and I do find it hard to let go. And I had it intellectually. I didn't have it here. And this has always been a battle with my first recovery, was I had it all up here. I didn't always feel it. You know, I could talk it and I genuinely walk it, but I didn't always feel it deep down and deep within. And I found out why they suggested not to have a relationship in your first year. I had three in my first 3 months. And then got honest and said that I had, and then had to leave my secondary the next day. And I remember it was because that I actually copped to it. It was either that or this guy that was going slightly mad that I hadn't actually done anything with, said that he had had to go and use heroin in Spain on his weekend out because he knew my secret. And bless him, he's still out there. I'm not. And I remember my my counsellor, I said, listen, I've done this. And she said, you have a chance because you finally got honest. And I came out and I was on my own. I didn't have any support, so I had to come to meetings at Christmas and reach out. And I wasn't very good at taking numbers, and there weren't that many, weren't a huge amount of women, it felt like, in the early days. And so the ones that I found were really precious. And the women that looked after me, I really hated myself. I had a lot of shame, a lot of guilt, and that lasted many, many years. They loved me until I kind of love myself. I mean, I'm not someone that looks in the mirror and goes, I love you. I'm sorry, I still find that a bit icky and a bit wanky. I'm not sure if that's a swear, so I apologise. But I can look in the mirror and think, you know what, you're all right. You know, I'm not the best human being, I'm not the worst. I learnt that in my step four. You know, I'm not an angel. I'm a little bit of a devil at times. But I'm somewhere in between. And I took service. I did service. I got a sponsor. I mean, this poor woman, I remember a year just sitting next to her at a meeting, and she went, well, hello, Zara. And I went, hi, will you be my sponsor? And she just looked at me. I'd only met her three times. And one of those wasn't actually really meeting her. It was just her going, I like your chair, in response to me doing a chair. And we went for coffee, and she remained my sponsor for 8 years. And we worked through the steps, and I stopped smoking, and I had dreadful relationships. I had quite okay relationships. I made friendships, and I repaired past relationships and past friendships. And I got a life, and I had jobs, and I lost jobs. And I had boyfriends, and I lost boyfriends. And I had friends, and we fell out, and we made out, and we fell out. And life went on, you know, just because, you know, for anyone in early days, it's not the easy route. It's an amazing path. And for me, it's incomparable. I would be dead. My doctor told me when I was 24 and I went to see him and said, I have a problem. He said, if you carry on, you won't see 30. Age 33, my life had gotten so good that I got a job of someone else's dreams, not necessarily mine, but it was a pretty cool job, travelling over the world, 500 men, 11 women, and motor cars. And I didn't go to the meeting for 6 months. I didn't call my sponsor. I didn't call my sponsees. And I didn't do any service. And I fitted in. That was the difference. I was with these crazy people travelling around the world, and they accepted me for who I was. And for the first time ever, I felt really one of them. And I got someone spiked my drink intentionally one night with vodka, and she giggled. There was Red Bull, and I hadn't really done that much Red Bull before, but because of the hours and I was knackered, I started doing that, and I'd started smoking again, which I'd given up. And I picked up in China, and I think I decided I was going to get really quite pissed that night, because then I could pull this guy that I quite fancy. Never happened. And he actually, 2 weeks later, said he preferred me sober. By then, it was too late. It took me 3 weeks to lose my job through drinking alone. And I then came back to London, having lost the job. And I bumped into a girlfriend of mine who had left the rooms 3 years previously, a good old friend of ours. And she was off to school. And I said, oh, I'll give you a lift. And I remember looking in my rearview mirror and watching her score off this guy with dreadlocks, and looking at his big Alsatian and thinking, that's going to be my dealer. And I took what she'd scored for a party that was 2 days later, and I think she had a couple bits of it, and I had the rest. And that night, I let down my friend that I used to work with, and I didn't turn up. And she learned that when I was using, I wouldn't answer the phone, and I wouldn't respond to texts. And in recovery, when I got back in, if she hadn't heard from me or I didn't respond, she'd ring up. Because it took a while for her to realise that my behaviour and my habits had now changed. It took, after about 3 months of that relapse, after 9.5 years of clean time, I was done. But it took me 13 months in total to get clean again. And this time, I did it by coming to meetings. And I started off going to women's meetings, and that was amazing, because the women that I had welcomed into the fellowship were welcoming me back. There really is, you know, when they talk about one addict helping another addict, there is no parallel. There really isn't. I sat there snivelling and snuffling, and my chest was shot to shit from the pipe. My nose was fucked from snort. I mean, just, my body was a wreck. My head was a wreck. My emotions were a wreck. But I did something that I hadn't done when I got clean before. I can never understand that bit when they said, if anyone's got anything on them, can they please take it outside? I would score before, I'd get a couple of rocks, and I'd put them in that tiny little pocket in your jeans, and I'd come in and I'd share, because I'm that selfish, because it is all about me being the newcomer, and then I'd go and I'd use. And then gradually I'd open up, and I'd actually go out for coffee afterwards, because I've never been very good at that. You know, there's half the fear, I'd like to leave just before the end. There was that fear of not being asked out, or that absolute terror of being asked out, going and realising that I've got nothing to say, and this is me, and I'm really boring, and me. Luckily, it's not all about me today. Days it is, well, hours it is, but it's not very long. You know, I stuck with this programme. I've got an amazing sponsor, and she doesn't pull any punches, which is great. I ring her up, and if there's anything I'm going to have a little moan about, the first thing she'll always say is, what's your part in it? To the point now, I ring her up going, I know what my part is. It's this, it's that. Can I just let you also know what their side was? And that's okay. And I've had jobs again in this recovery, and I've lost jobs again, and I've remade friendships. And one big thing was I had to make new friends this time. The people that I hung out in recovery last time, not all were still here, and they'd moved on in different places. And if I'm being really honest, my recovery is very different this time. It's more real. I'm more real. It has been much more painful. It has been really hard fought for and hard won. I mean, took a snot. God, have I cried. I've cried not out of self-pity, but out of genuine pain, real sadness. You know, when I sit in a meeting and I do well, it's usually, you know, it's out of empathy. You know, when I hear someone else tell my story, when I hear a newcomer share for the first time, you know, they talk about that God's hole. It's actually my solar plexus. And, you know, that's where my anxiety's kept. And what replaces that horrible scrunching feeling is that, you know, when I do hear a newcomer share honestly, and I get this, it's almost, I used to describe it, it's like warm treacle welling up in me. And, you know, I like to think that's my heart opening, you know, because it was pretty shut down for a long time, you know. And I've done the steps again, I think for the third time. And so I'm back on 10, having for the last month. And it hasn't been easy, but I've never felt comfortable in my own skin, ever. And now, as a result of continually working this program, I get to feel comfortable in my own skin. Otherwise, I wouldn't have hung around. Also, the drugs stopped working. You know, they altered the way I felt, then they numbed the way I felt, and then they just compounded every shitty... I've done it again, I'm sorry. Every bad feeling. You know, the shame, the guilt, the fear, just crippling. And I'm not crippled anymore. You know, I was restored to dignity. And the only person in this room that can take that dignity away is me. And I have done, usually over a man. You know, I've done it a few times, and I'm not perfect. But another thing is I've been able to take this programme into all areas of my life. you know, I'm a reliable employee. I'm quite anal about it, actually. I'm always the first there. But I will leave on time, you know, because I have a life. You know, I exercise regularly. You know, we talk about step 11. You know, my form of meditation is swim. Unfortunately, I get pool rage, so I can only actually do it when it's just me on my own in the pool, which I've had the last few days. When I get ill in recovery, which happens once or twice a year, my emotions become like a newcomer again. I get very needy, very sensitive, which is quite female as well. You know, so if there's a full moon to boot and I'm ill on top of it and I'm hormonal, you know, I tend not to go to meetings because I don't trust myself to speak to anything because I don't know what's going to come out of my mouth. You know, they talk about flight or fly. It's more like kill or cry, you know, for me. And that's just me. I still do service. I have a lovely sponsee who, oh, gosh, she's just incredible. She's one of the greatest gifts of this recovery. My sponsees and my other were too, but she just reminds me. And, you know, when I do give her the odd suggestion, you know, I think, oh, I really should listen to my own stuff on occasion. Because it's all come from my sponsor. And that's come from her sponsor. And that's great. And, you know, my higher power, as I said, has changed over the years. Ultimately, the voice of my higher power is through my friends and my sponsor. Because my idea of reality, if I haven't been to a meeting for a few days, can be a bit winky-wonky. You know, and it's not actually often reality. And I ring up and I say, listen, this is where my head's at and this is the situation. And there'll usually be a silence followed by a bit of a giggle. And they'll be like, okay, do you want to hear what I think it really, you know, where reality is? And I calm down and then I'll listen. I never really listened before, or I listened but didn't actually hear. And not all the time, but most of the time I do. And I was just thinking on the way over, when I came in, I used to hear something I don't hardly ever hear anymore now, that, you know, recovery and meetings are a step to, you know, bridge to normal living. And I don't hear that very much. And for me, they are, because I think a big reason, or the difference in my two recoveries, is in my first recovery, it was all NA. You know, I hung out with NA, I did NA dances, I didn't hang out with my old friends much, you know. And then all of a sudden, I had this great job, and that's all I did. It was all about anything but recovery and my recovery friends. And this time, you know, I look at my godchildren. One's mother's in recovery, one isn't and doesn't need it. You know, it's all quite symbiotic. I have friends that just aren't addicts. They've got loads of friggin' isms. And, you know, we don't have the cornerstone and a lot of, you know, our lovely little bits of our character that don't work so well that might be slightly defective. But, you know, we're all human. I think we just experience ours that little bit more. And that's okay. And, you know, I need to go to meetings and I need to connect and I need to identify and I need to do my program. But I can go out and be that good employee. That I can be a sponsor that listens. You know, that I can be a good friend again. I can be a great godmother. And more recently, I can be a good daughter. As I said, my mum suffers from this disease and, you know, she knows that, she admits it, she's not prepared to do anything about it. She says she can't, i.e. she won't. And I've lived the past 20 years, actually 21. My father has Asperger's, so it was only recently diagnosed. And when things go tits up, when it's not feast and it's famine, three times he's tried to kill himself and hasn't succeeded, bless him, as my mum, you know. But it's been more of a cry for help. My mum, I've always waited for the day when I get the call. And I got the call 6 weeks ago that for the first time ever, she'd taken an overdose. And that's what she was talking about before the meeting. You know, let them know that whatever happens, they don't have to pick up. And I'm just thinking, well, this is the forced suicide attempt of a parent. And of course I haven't picked up. I've lost my grandparents, my cousin in early recovery. I've lost countless friends to the disease of addiction during recovery as a result of their addiction or to do with cancer. I haven't picked up. And I cope with it because I'm used to dealing with someone in pain. And it was so nice to be the daughter I'd always wanted to be. And the hard bit was for me was I said, have you got any more pills? And she handed me over. She'd been stockpiling DF118s and diamorphine. The weird thing was, my natural reaction was to shove them in the bin. It had to be a Sharps box, which wasn't ideal. When I got home eventually that night, I thought, I wonder how much money I could have made out of those. Naturally, having kept a few, because I wasn't very good at dealing. Five left, my God. I wasn't a very good dealer because I did get high on my own supply, and I just cut everything that was left, and then I'd get a bad reputation, and I wasn't very clever at that. I don't know how very clever. The only thing that I really have been... Well, not the only thing. The first thing I was ever successful about was doing completing the 12 steps. I'm a very good starter. I was never so good. I'd get bored halfway through, or I'd find out that someone was much better than I am at it, and I'd give up. And because I managed to do those 12 steps, I learned how to keep jobs, and I learned to stop smoking and start smoking and stop again. And a couple of years ago, I'd done a little course, and it was something I was quite good at. And I was told I was quite good at, and I couldn't afford to do the full diploma. And then something out of the blue, someone was able to help me, and they said, and I said, but I can't pay you back. And she said, I'd just like you to do it for someone else in future. Going forward, which I actually have been in a position to do so, and I did this course, and it was really hard because I had to hold down a job during it, and it's something that allows me to give back. You know, some of it I get paid for, some of it I give freely because I can. And you know, today I'm still dealing with difficult people in my life. My life's not perfect. I'm not perfect. I think it'd be a bit boring. I think I'm a bit of a perfectionist, but I've kind of let go, you know. Going through the steps, so it's looking at the boring repetitiveness of step five. I mean, it wasn't the big shameful things that I thought were rude. That was why I used. It was the little petty things that I used, or mainly my dishonesty. I find it hard to stand to my own truth and tell you when my feelings are hurt, or when you've pissed me off, or when... for fear of rejection and abandonment, which I think is at the core of my greatest fears. I don't know whether it's an illness, I don't know whether it's a disease. I'm not over the moon that I'm an addict. I'm really glad to know I am. Because it's, you know, when I forget, I come to a meeting and I'm reminded, there's that friggin' addiction in it. And that's okay. And also I'm female and, you know, it's not that easy. Going forward, I don't know what happens in my life. I've got a little idea of what I'd like to happen. And I was thinking, you know, I don't make New Year's resolutions. Because I just set myself up to fail, really. Or I get really controlled and obsessed about it, and it's a be-all and end-all. I just want to carry on doing the good things that I do, and maybe a little bit less of, you know, the things that I'm not so happy. If something gets uncomfortable enough for me and painful enough, I know it has to go from my life. If I'm doing something that makes me happy, I can have a little bit more. Of course, me being, I want a lot more than I go over a board. You know, it's always going to be a bit of a battle in my head, with my head, and with everyone else's head. You know, I just try not to get into your heads these days. You know, I remember someone saying to me very early in recovery, because I was thinking, I cannot change. I don't think it's possible. And she explained to me that she believed a leopard can't change its spots, but they can fade. And if that's as good as my recovery gets, if I can soften the hard edges, strengthen the frailties and the weaknesses, that then I'm doing all right. My essence is, I am a little bit of a madam. You know, I do talk rubbish at times, but it's real rubbish and it's truthful and it's honest, because I'm not very good at lying. You know, I think with my heart too much, and then my head goes off in a tangent. And I think what I've tried to do over, I'm going to be 6 years, touch wood, it might be plastic, but I think it's wood. next Tuesday, I'm going to be 6 years back again. And... well done, everyone around me, for putting up with me. And for me putting up with me and having faith and having courage and just knowing that I can't do it on my own. And, you know, as a natural isolator, spending years of splendid isolation, that doesn't feel comfortable anymore. You know, I used to feel comfortable in my misery. I don't. And, you know, I'm aware now that there is so much more on offer. If this is as good as my life gets today, I'll be feel a little bit shortchanged. But you know what? My lot's not a bad lot. I'm not the worst person, I'm not the best, and that's okay. I've learned what balance is. I don't see it that often, but I've learned what it is. And when I come to meetings, and I do my swimming, when I do a just enough of everything, I feel grounded. When I do too many meetings, I hate you all. When I do too little, I hate myself. So there's my balance, the magic power of three for me. I hope I've made some sense. Anyone in their early days, this is the best gig in town. If you didn't identify with me, just remember not answering the door because it was your dealer you owed money to, or the bailiffs, or even worse, whoever was your last point of cash. I remember the empty, I'm talking for myself, all the old Domino's pizzas, like crusty things that were underneath my bed, you know, the post that didn't get opened, the fact that the telly was turned down. I'd actually try and unwire the doorbell so, because my heart couldn't take it. All that shit I got back because it was mortgaged out to recovery and I massively defaulted. Got every bit of misery back. And today I've got all the bits of joy back. I can still ruin that, but I'm choosing not to today. And again, thank you all.
Thank you.